Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Hello, it's Gordon.
Hi, Gordon. Jill Pasternak here at WRTI in Philadelphia.
Hey, Jill. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm waking myself up.
I was going to say you sound very perky for just waking up.
It's an illusion, but hopefully I can sustain it for a few more minutes.
Well, at least I'm delighted that we could get an interview with you so fast.
My pleasure.
Yeah, this station has a dual format. We're half classical and half jazz.
Were there to be more people that had who didn't have so many borders around what the music should be, and didn't have to compartmentalize everything?
Yeah.
So much.
Well, of course, you know, there's a big that's not a big difference. The more composers I talk to, the more they say, "Well, I don't see the difference," you know. So it's. Kind of
When I came into college, it was that way. There was a pretty broad line between the classical guys and the jazz guys. But you're right. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore, for sure.
Well, I just want to tell you that you are fabulous with a PH.
Oh, well, thank you.
Really, it's just wonderful. Your new album.
Well, thanks so much.
It's 9 o'clock there now. Is that right?
Yeah, it's 9 o'clock.
Okay.
I'm actually working on a movie right now, and we're kind of in the last week before our sessions.
Oh my! So you're very busy.
I worked till about 1 o'clock, and then got into bed, and then my mind was just firing. You know?
Yes, yes.
Because I knew we had to get up and do this, and I have a bunch of other things going today. So it took me a couple hours just to okay, come on. Pull it down. Now's the time for sleeping.
Yeah, that doesn't work. I think a lot of us suffer with that, especially when you have so much going on. Now, you've done film. I mean, quite a bit of it. Isn't that
a good
part
thing,
of your background?
Because now, in this day and age, writing big band music isn't the key to financial security. I mean, the way it's worked out for me is I've had to keep a delicate balance between the the film work that I do, which is really what pays all the bills, and then the big band writing and recording and performing, which is turned into a lifelong love. I mean, I started doing it in seventh grade. It's my first big band chart I wrote was in middle school. And the minute I heard the genre, I said, man, this is it for me. I'm home here. And I don't even know why, because I really hadn't had a particularly musical background with my family or anything. They had Glenn Miller records kind of
sure.
around the house,
Mm-hmm.
But I heard Count Basie in seventh grade and knew that was what I was going to do.
I have to tell you, you're an oasis in the desert here. To hear a band like yours, which is, they're virtuosic. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic, the guys that you have playing. And the arrangements, of course, are reminiscent to some degree of the big band era. But it's very contemporary as well. And
that's a good statement. I'm glad to hear you see that, because that's the big band era is certainly just a jumping off point for us, and we to pay homage to those guys. But my influences as a composer are pretty wide. I mean, even though I started off when I went to college at Cal State Northridge, I was just a jazz guy, and I was pretty snobby about it. I didn't like pop music of any kind. I didn't know Bach from Beethoven or from Stravinsky,
Right.
But in going to school at that time, they didn't have a jazz major. And for me, it's a good thing they didn't, because by taking the music history classes and orchestration and counterpoint, and it broadened my point of view so much that I would not be doing the film work that I'm doing as a conductor and orchestrator and composer if I didn't have that experience. So,
well, I just interviewed Lalo Schifrin a couple of weeks ago. Of course, you know him. I mean, one of the great film writers, of course. He went to the Paris Conservatory. That's what his background was. But he was playing jazz at the same time. And I think that you have to have that background. I mean, music is music. And whoever thinks that you can just sit down and be inspired, I think, is foolish. You've got to know what you're doing.
I couldn't agree more with that. And our culture kind of romanticizes the the left or the right brain part of it, where you're waiting for God-given inspiration. And my point of view is that God-given talent is important, to be sure, but I think that you rest that on the foundation of your preparation and your study. And there's, I think, many artists who feel that, you know, that they sit and what they can do on an intuitive sense is enough, and I don't think it is. I would even have to include some of our greatest jazz players, in the genre, who you can hear their technical limitations, and it becomes part of their style, to be sure. You know,
right? Of course, yes, absolutely. You're so right.
Yeah, and that's not to say that I don't enjoy, much of the work that they do, but I think it could be better if they had would have had the access to study and to broaden their skills.
Well, you really hit it. I mean, your knowledge. Again, the more knowledge you have, the more you can work with, and when you build a little, just a frame of reference, and you can't go beyond that, you are limited, and then you begin to develop, as you say, a style within that limitation. Now, not having read your background at first, when I looked at the new album, The Fat Pack, I looked at the titles, and I said, what are these titles? They're pretty weird. I mean, I knew it was a very good year, and Too Close for Comfort, but I said, what is this? And, of course, then I realized you had done cartoon tracks. Is that right?
Initially. I spent 5 years working at Warner Brothers Animation, and that was a real golden era because we probably had about 8 series that were going around that time. And this is in the 90s. And there's a group of about 5 of us on the staff there. We weren't really on the staff, but we were the 5 people that they went to compose their music, and we were the benefits of a statement made by Steven Spielberg when Warner Brothers put out a show called it was called Tiny Toons, and basically Steven Spielberg was executive producer, and he said, look, you can put my name on it, but I have a couple of conditions, and one is that you score every episode with an orchestra. No synthesizers, and you don't library any music. You compose underscore for every cartoon.
That's a man after our own heart here. That's fantastic.
Boy, yeah, and that one statement led to 10 years of work for musicians here in L.A. and also 10 years of that kind of scoring. And so I worked for about half of it there, for about 5 years, and I became really immersed in the music of Carl Stalling, who wrote all the classic.
The Bugs Bunny thing. Right. We have an album, actually, of that, all those things.
Oh, boy. I mean, I spent so much time with that album because I had to learn it to really, learn, what devices did he use and what was his approach. And
It is a technique, though, isn't it, for writing?
Yeah. Oh, well, Carl Stalling, I mean, it was probably the first classical music I ever heard was in a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Sure, of course, that's the truth, right?
Now, it's interesting because both of my loves of animation and jazz kind of came together recently because Warner Brothers had us do the music for a Christmas Carol retelling with Bugs and Daffy. It's called Bah Humduck. And they called up and they said, we want big band jazz for this. Are you in? And I said, big band jazz and Warner Brothers Animation. And I thought those are the two things I didn't have a real affection for.
The dream come true. But what do you think of this whole business of animation? I mean, it's really taken over to the degree that it's not really for kids anymore. It's really, long form feature films and so on.
Well, if you read interviews with Chuck Jones and those guys back in the day, they were making those cartoons for adults because they put tons of adult references and, sly humor that went over the kids' heads. Now, the kids are watching it because the characters are running and hitting each other and falling around. But there was a pretty high level of sophistication in the humor that they used.
Right.
So, clearly, the Hollywood has seen that there's a big market. But it's actually helped us out in terms of trying to market the Big Fat Band. Because if you take, like with this thing coming, it's coming out this Christmas, Bah Humduck, we're releasing a soundtrack along with the DVD. So I think it's going to be bundled with the DVD. So in other words, you go into Ralph's or Vaughn's or Long's drugstore and buy the Bah Humduck DVD, you'll get our soundtrack album. Right. And there's like a whole audience that's going to be able to hear big band music that wouldn't have. Like I worked on a movie called The Incredibles by Pixar.
Yes.
Hugely successful movie. And the director wanted that big band style. So So it's funny because I'll ask kids, like, have you guys ever heard of big band? And nobody really raises their hand. I go, well, did you see The Incredibles? Oh, yeah, we loved it. Well, then you did hear a big band. And then they realize, so that when they, it kind of works in their way in their subconscious, you know. So then when they hear big band music, it doesn't sound quite as weird and alien to them. So,
well, you know, I'm it's very odd that the directors, you know, or the people in charge really want that. I mean, I wonder why. I wonder why they have chosen that and specified that.
You know, I asked them three times, are you sure you want big band music? Are you sure that's what you want? Because I can't do it with synthesizers. They say, okay, no, you don't have to use a synthesizer. And we're able to use the big fat band in the sessions for the score. So I don't know why. And I was glad that they went for whatever their reasons. And they really ended up loving it. And to be truthful, though, when I started to score the piece, it was hard to look at Bugs Bunny and not hear Carl Stone.
I'll bet.
So I ended up doing kind of a composite of a kind of a big band jazz thing and Carl Stalling's music.
You know what's fabulous on this new album? The Attack of the Killer Tomatoes is really wonderful.
Yeah, well.
Love that.
Did you see the movie?
Nope. I never saw it.
Well, I'm thank you for being honest, because if you tried to watch it, if you got through more than 15 minutes, it was truly terrible.
A bomb.
It was my very first movie I did right out of college.
Oh, but this is wonderful.
Well, I know, I finally kind of embraced my past, because it was such an awful movie. But matter of fact, it was so awful, which what gave it its cult status. And so we had a little bit of fun with it.
Can we backtrack a little? Tell us your Stan Kenton story. You sent him a composition, right?
Well,
when you were 15?
Stan Kenton, he was one of the first guys that figured out that big bands could exist in the U.S. educational system, that there was a home for them and a way for the music to survive, because there wasn't ballrooms for big bands to play in anymore. You know, mm-hmm. You can't fit them in most clubs.
Sure.
The money and all the travel problems.
Right.
So he used to have these things called Stan Kenton jazz clinics, and he had a couple out here in California. And if you were a jazz musician in California in the 70s, you went to those clinics. That was a destination for you every summer. So my second time there, they had a contest. And basically, it was a clinic, a week-long clinic, and the Kenton Band was there. So you got to hang with those guys and, you know, really immerse yourself. And he had a contest, and I won the contest. So then I got to go up and conduct his band as, you know, as a 15-year-old kid with him playing piano. It was, I mean, I still remember it,
Well, Kenton was, we called it progressive jazz then. I mean, Stan
right,
Kenton.
Right.
Progressive jazz. And then, of course, Sauter Finnegan with the other one. I mean, that was a classical jazz band, I think. We had all the classical players playing. I wanted to ask you about the arrangements that you write. Do you write out any of the, I'm sure you must let the player improvise, but is there at some point, do you, you know, tell them what you want?
I think that over the years, and the band's been in existence since 1999, and I think that we have started to carve out a sound because as you say, the players are, you know, there's nothing
fantastic,
they can't play.
Really fabulous.
And so, but when we first got together, it was just a group of excellent players, and everything's in tune, and everything's perfectly, you know, in rhythm and all that. No wrong notes. But that doesn't really make you a band yet. How do you get, like, a little more inside the music, like Count Basie's band was,
right,
where they were on the road every night playing the same charts, and then it kind of goes beyond what's on the
sure,
page.
Sure, of course.
And I don't think there's a shortcut to that, especially because it's not like we can rehearse. I mean, we rehearse maybe once, twice a year at most, because everyone's schedule is so busy. So I think over the last 5 years, we've kind of gotten that nuance from just playing the music, and we've developed a point of view. So I have to say, and I try not to say too much when they're improvising, because basically our thing is that we're a team, and we don't allow any expression of ego when we're playing in the band.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can hear, there are a lot of great bands where there were a group of great individuals,
mm-hmm.
but you can hear them cheating. You can hear them playing with, maybe one guy plays a little different vibrato, or he holds his note a little bit
right.
longer here or there.
To stand out.
Yeah, and we don't allow it, and, you know.
You feel that. I have to tell you, it's tight, very, very tight.
It's a real priority for us, and we try to nurture the love of playing in an ensemble. You know, you have to take pride in that. Now, when it's time for your solo, that's a whole other deal.
Yeah.
So I really try to get, when it's time for them to play a solo, you know, they can take her where they want to. I think a lot of them have kind of, they go with the flow, you know, and if our thing is a high energy, precise, you know, whatever it is, you know, they tend to go there. But we do try to strike a balance, you know, between keeping the spontaneity that's important in jazz, but also making sure that we are, you know, prepared and tight. And I think you owe it to your audience, frankly. I think jazz musicians, here, let me get on the soapbox real quick.
That's fine.
I think jazz musicians have done their audience a disservice by feeling like, I play so well, that's enough. You come to me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to announce what songs I'm playing. I can go up and just fake through a set without really preparing or rehearsing. I think we're paying the price for that because of, you know, well, we have a 3% marketplace share, and the music is struggling, you know, to stay relevant. And part of the reason, I think, is that we don't know how to market this music.
Well,
we
also, people are very superficial, and it's kind of cool, you know, to like jazz. I mean, that's kind of the thing. And they don't want to admit that they don't know what's going on, because in most cases, they really don't. You have a big percentage of your audience loves what they hear, but they don't understand what's going on, and they don't admit it. And I think that's why a lot of the players could get away with that. But I agree with you.
Would they know what was going on if they listened to, you know, the Rite of Spring?
No, probably.
Or Bartok Concerto for Orchestra?
Exactly.
Would they know?
No, they probably wouldn't.
I don't know if they have to know particularly what's going on, but I, you know what? I think they used to know a lot more than they do now. You know the Leonard Bernstein Children's Concert.
Yes, of course.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're out on DVD now.
Well, we actually ran them on our fun drive for a while.
And I'm looking at that, and I go, now, this is a concert. Now, when were they? In, like, late 50s and mm-hmm. early 60s. So he did that, designed as to introduce children to classical music. And I said, "This, you should show this to an average adult, and he wouldn't be able to keep up nowadays.
Right, right. Well, and of course, music has changed. You are really playing. For me, it was a kind of a nostalgic feeling. But again, there was something so current about what you're doing. And I loved the cleanness of the ensemble. I mean, you really are... That really got me, because in some passages there, I mean, you're really all together. It's wonderful. Superb.
Here's the next goal that we have, and I appreciate those sentiments very much, is that when you hear us live, there's not a drop-off. Because you can cheat nowadays in a recording studio, without a doubt. And, you know, you can do multiple takes,
fix it
in Pro Tools. There's so much you can do. On the Fat Pack, there's a bonus DVD.
Yes.
And there's some videos on there. Included in there, there's a recording session video where you can hear the audio off the mic on the camera of us recording. I think it's the first tune, Cut and Run, which is really fast and precise and all that. And you can hear us in the studio playing it. And it's, I was happy to put that on there because I think people wonder, how do these guys play this music so tight? You know, do they cheat? Do they fix it in the mix?
That first track, I mean, that is out of this world. And I was so taken with it. So you really worked on that.
Well, you know, we certainly did, but it's, I think it's kind of a mental, discipline that the guys in the band. Now, these guys are all studio musicians, so they're used to going into mm-hmm. a recording session and looking at the music and sight reading it perfectly.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And then recording it on the next take. That's
right.
Their lives every day.
They do it.
Like I said, that's a starting place, but for us, it isn't enough. We have to make sure that, okay, it doesn't feel too sterile. It has to have some music there as well. And but, you know, the guys in the band, they're old friends. Some of them go back, you know, I've known since high school. We've grown up and gotten into the music business together. And, I mean, what's better than that, to be able to, you know, have a band and have something that's kind of working with people you would want to hang out with and be friends with, you know, anyway. So
wow.
I feel so lucky to have those guys. And they're the ones, people talk about how hard the music is. It's their fault. Because they keep playing it. They keep raising the bar with everything I write.
Yeah, but they're lucky to have you. I have to say, I mean, you've brought a new sound, a new old sound back. I mean, it's great. And you yourself, I mean, you studied, weren't you a pianist to begin with? You studied saxophone also.
Yeah, I started piano when I was in kindergarten, kicking and screaming, hated it. You know, my parents made me do it. And I picked up clarinet in fourth grade. Took to that pretty well. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, talk about you know, the preparation. Maybe I'm a little more sensitive to that because in all the instruments I played, I wanted to get to the music so quickly that I neglected the basics. Like I didn't practice my scales and hand and exercises as a piano player, young piano player. Now my teacher was able to use that because my piano teacher was the first one to say, hey, you know what, maybe I think this kid could write music. So she had me writing little polkas and marches and, you know, every week I'd write a different style. But she'd always say, but do your scales, keep going. Now I didn't do my scales. So I developed some flaws in my technique that I had to go back and correct later as an adult. I used to get terribly sore wrists. My wrist was so tense because I wasn't playing correctly. I wasn't breathing as I was playing the piano. Same thing with the clarinet. Same thing with the saxophone. I developed bad habits because I just jumped in and tried to get to the music. And I had enough natural talent that I could play, and I sounded good. I sounded better than most kids. But
they're very different techniques. A piano technique is very different from any kind of a wind instrument. I mean,
it certainly is.
World.
And I had a humiliating saxophone lesson with Phil Woods.
I was going to ask you about your study with Phil Woods.
He looked at me. I went in to take a lesson from him, and I'm coming out of high school. Just was played at Monterey Jazz Festival with an all-star high school band. Made the top band at Northridge as a freshman. I'm hot, you know. I'm feeling it. And I go to take my lesson with Phil.
To the maestro there.
And he looks at me, and he hears me play, and he goes, hey, stop. Just stop.
Oh, my.
He goes, Vic, come here. I go, Vic? Who's Vic? And he goes, come here. Give Vic your horn. So this other guy walks in the room, and I hand him my alto, and he picks it up and goes, L-l-l-l-l-l-l-l-l-l-l. He goes, the horn's fine, hands it back to me. Phil goes, man, you got to get your you-know-what together before you come to me. What are you doing here?
Ooh.
And this is my worst nightmare. This is my idol, you know, and he's looking at me like I had walked into the lesson naked or something, you know.
Right.
He's disgusted with me. And he goes, you have so many technical problems. He goes, call me in 5 years, you know.
Interesting.
And I'm sitting there. Oh, so Vic goes, come here, kid. Let me show you what you're doing wrong. So his name was Vic Morosco, who was a session player at the time here in L.A. And Phil was living with him. So Vic straightened me out, changed my embouchure. You know, when you change your embouchure on an instrument, you lose all your control.
I think for the audience who's listening, the embouchure, of course, is the lip.
How your lips go around the mouthpiece.
Yeah.
So Vic goes, all right, now play a low B flat. Here, now roll your lip out, make a nice pad for the reed. Okay, now play a low B flat. So I'm like, you know, like I sound awful. I sound like a third grader.
Mm.
And Phil is sitting on the couch looking at me, and I'm going on a low B flat, and it was just. But you know what? Phil did the best favor he could ever do for me because he, you know, cut right to it and said, you know, you've been cheating this whole time and you got by, but not anymore. Come on. And the postscript to that is I 10 years after that, I had written a piece for orchestra for the great trombonist Bill Watrous, and we were playing it with an orchestra out here in L.A. at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And on the program is Phil Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting before the concert. And Bill is in here introducing me to him. Here's, oh, Bill, Gordon, this is Quincy Jones. Oh, nice to meet you. And, oh, this is Phil Woods. And Phil looks at me and he goes, I see you got your act together.
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that nice? So
very nice. Thank you so much, Gordon, for speaking with us and telling us how you feel about everything. You are, as I said, fantastic with a PH.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for having me on today. I have had a great time, and I appreciate you playing the record and all your support, too.
And I look forward to your next one.
I better get to work on that.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.